actually, I think we should get famous and chew pickles. Do ASMR. It could just be you eating anything.
Yeah.
Because you smack your lips a lot.
I try not to.
Really?
I think about closing my mouth when I eat a lot.
Why don't you do it then?
Welcome to another episode of the MacGuffin Podcast, the film review podcast that dreams are made of. I am Cassidy Robinson from, where am I from now?
Las Vegas, Nevada.
Keith is not here with us today. The dog ate his homework. So in his stead, I have my roommate and movie buddy, friend of the show, Ashley Hitchcock.
Yeah, I've been on here a few times before. It's good to be back.
Yeah. Live in studio.
Yes.
My bedroom, aka your old guest room.
Yes.
Today we're going to be talking about a lot of movies because, like I said, you're my movie buddy. We both go see everything on weekends.
Yeah.
I'm so used to going to movies by myself.
Is it nice to go to someone or with someone?
There was a lot of times because we both use the... do I want to plug the AMC Stubs?
Absolutely. Stubs list? It's the best.
Yeah. We use that after MoviePass crash and burned.
Yep.
We moved over, like a lot of people, I think, to the AMC Stubs list because you get, what is it, 3 movies a week for $20 a month?
Yep.
Kind of hard to beat right now.
You get a priority line in the concessions, mm-hmm. so you can go in front of everyone that's in the regular line, so a VIP treatment all the way, and then you can pick out whatever movie you want to see a week in advance and buy and reserve your seat.
Yeah, and it's good for everything, including dine-in theaters or their 3D or
IMAX,
yep. whatever.
Absolutely.
So now this is an official ad for AMC Stubs List. And I expect a kickback from it from AMC.
Absolutely. Hit us up, AMC.
But anyway, yeah, so because of that, you don't have a problem with going to movies that you're almost certainly not going to like?
Yes. Yeah, no problem. it's you save so much money by just having a subscription, which is, it's great. I wish movie theaters had done this long before this. So.
Right. And we'll see how other chains, they're all kind of trying to do their own version of it right now.
Right.
It's kind of like the streamocalypse where all of the different channels are trying to like come up with their own subscription plans. And at some point they're going to have to consolidate in some sort of normal way because nobody can subscribe to like 16 different plans.
Exactly. Like CBS, fuck you. No one wants to subscribe to only your CBS channel.
Well, we lost their endorsement now.
Yeah.
Yeah, so because of that, we have a lot of movies to catch up with. What was the list again?
Rocket Man, The Dead Don't Die, Dark Phoenix, and Men in Black International.
We're going to do those, and if we have a little bit of time at the end, maybe for our Netflix homework, we'll talk about that Jonas Brothers doc.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we did have a couple things here that was planned for when I thought Keith was going to be on the episode. We did a listener survey. I just asked everybody what is their favorite movie in the X-Men franchise, because supposedly Dark Phoenix is supposed to be the last of this movie universe version of X-Men that started in 1998 or 99 with Bryan Singer's X-Men and has continued on through now. Even though there is a New Mutants movie that's in the it's got shelved, basically. It was filmed almost around the same time as Dark Phoenix. And it was, like, going to be, like, a X-Men horror film. I know that the studio, 20th Century Fox, got nervous about it because this was the time when all superhero movies now had to be funny. And so they, like, went back and did a bunch of reshoots to, like, make it more lighthearted. And then it ended up just being such a mess that they, it's been, I think, shelved indefinitely. I don't know. there might be a release date in 2020.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. So, but until we know more about that, Dark Phoenix is the last of its kind. So we're going to take a look back here to the previous X-Men universe. And you actually responded to this, but we will, I'll let you give your answer out later. But Hillary Stevens says that X2 and Days of Future Past are her favorites. Chris Fowler, her husband, says X2 and Logan is his favorites. Alyssa Whitty says Days of Future Past and Logan. Robert Barnett says Logan by a mile. Ted says Logan. So I think Logan so far is the winner.
Absolutely. As it should be.
And then we got some responses here on Twitter as well. Todd Flatland says X-Men First Class is better than Logan. Or he says, I still maintain that X-Men First Class is better than Logan, though by a slim margin. Logan is a great character study, but First Class is a great X-Men movie.
That's true.
I have unpopular opinions about X-Men First Class.
Okay, we'll get into that.
Patrick, friend of the show Patrick, says X-Men First Class. And then he says, does Logan count? Of course it does. And then, at IF Comic says, there's no contest, Logan. And then Terry Vickroy says, if Logan counts, I pick that. If I can't pick Logan, then it's X2.
Hmm.
So it seems like Logan's the winner.
Definitely.
With some contention about maybe second place is First Class and then X2 underneath
that.
So my original plan when I was putting this all together is that I would read all of these responses and then me and Keith would rank them. I know that there's some of them that you haven't seen still. Mm-hmm. Some of the earlier ones, I think, right?
I think I haven't. Well, I know I haven't seen X2 and then the third one.
X-Men Last Stand.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I did not see Wolverine, which everyone hated.
Which Wolverine?
Like the one everyone hated with Ryan Reynolds with his mouth stitched shut.
X-Men Origins Wolverine.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Yeah. That was the first. That was a Wolverine origin story, kind of.
But that's still totally in that universe.
It's 100%. Yes.
Yeah, okay.
I haven't seen all of them. There's probably somebody out there for whom that is their favorite. I don't know what that kind of person is like, but I'd be interested in meeting them.
Okay.
Do you want to give off your favorites?
Well, I really like Days of Future Past because there's a lot of fun to be had in it. We've kind of already established the characters from First Class, and you get to meet Quicksilver, who is such a blast to see him breaking Magneto out of prison. And
there's a lot of fun scenes in that movie.
Lots of fun scenes, but also a lot of good action. And I think that the story is pretty compelling. I really like Peter Dinklage's performance. So.
Oh, yeah, he's in that.
Yeah, I really like that one.
He's the scientist who creates the Sentinels.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then my second answer was Logan, because I saw that and it just blew me away. It was incredible.
Okay. All right. My favorite X-Men movie to date is still X-Men 2 or X2, X-Men United. Came out in 2003. I think we talk a lot of them here about like how the superhero genre has changed over years. And this was, the first two X-Men movies and then later Spider-Man. Kind of reestablished or redefined what the superhero genre was after there'd just been a smattering of Superman and Batman movies over the 20 years prior. And he was the first one that kind of like took the genre seriously. But I think everything that is kind of lacks in the first X-Men movie, which is that it's a little dull sometimes, and the last third doesn't really work on an action level. But he was really good at establishing a few things, and that is the X-Men this kind of the idea of a world, a believable world where humans and mutants coexist, and there's like this political struggle going on.
Yeah, yeah.
And the whole allegory of racism and sexism and homophobia and all of that stuff that's always been in the X-Men lore, I think he tapped into really well. And I think that the stuff that didn't work in the first one, which is the action sequences, some of the special effects, and just generally being a little poppier, works better in X2. So his interpretation of the comics and everything has always been fairly different, and the series as a whole takes its own way with things, and sometimes will change its mind on things that it decides to do halfway through the series. But I think that the X2 so far is the best balance. After X2, yeah, I'd probably go with Logan. The rest, for the most part, are varying degrees of really good for a superhero movie or within that genre. But Logan was the first of an X-Men movie, I think, that ended up on my top 10 of the year among, like, all kinds of movies. It was just a really good action movie, a lot darker, but that's not necessarily what makes it better. It just felt like, you know, it felt unshackled from all of the...
Yeah, it doesn't have to fit into any universe or cookie cutter, because ultimately...
It's kind of its own thing.
Right, it's just about, like, this one man's redemption and the lengths he's going to go to make it happen.
Yeah, it's kind of like a good futuristic spaghetti western action movie. A lot of parallels to Terminator 2 in that way. I'm with everybody in saying Logan is great. So that's where I am with the X-Men movies as they stand. Now, I left out the Deadpool movies because I think they're kind of their own thing.
They are absolutely their own thing.
Even though they kind of tie into the X-Men universe, and I have stated online more than once that I think Deadpool 2 is a better X-Men movie than, like, some of the last three or four we've had.
Okay.
there's certain stuff in that movie, especially how they deal with Cable and stuff, that I really like. But yeah, I don't necessarily include them in all this. Do you think, now that X-Men is over and it's going to be handed over to Disney, that they are going to continue, that Disney is going to continue with the Deadpool franchise? As it is, because it's this hard R, weird, postmodern superhero comedy that's not really in the business that Disney's doing right now.
Well, Disney, I think because they acquired certain things like Fox, I think they have no choice but to... I think that they're going to still have to make movies that are not for children and family.
Yeah.
After acquiring Fox, like, that's a new level of responsibility for you to make entertainment for adults, and you have to be ready to do that. So I don't know if they're going to make a third Deadpool, but no idea. I mean, I know they bought Hulu to keep Fox stuff and other kind of adult stuff streaming on Hulu, and that's why Disney Plus is going to be all kids and family stuff. So they're going to have two streaming platforms that they own, basically, that are going to have different content. So that's an example there of the way they're going to try and keep it separate.
Right. Yeah, I just wonder, because I feel like that's still, there's a lot of gas left in the Deadpool car.
Oh, yeah.
And it'd be dumb of them or whoever to just abandon that world. At this point, we'll see if they can pull off a third one. But I think there was a little, for some people, they didn't like Deadpool 2 as much as
I didn't
they
like the
first
much.
One. Yeah. I happen to like it more than the first one.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that that's not necessarily the popular take. I think we should just go right into Dark Phoenix from
here.
Yeah,
makes sense.
We've been talking about X-Men. Let's keep doing that. And Ashley, since I've been doing a lot of talking, why don't you go ahead and describe what happens in Dark Phoenix?
Oh, man. I don't remember.
If you want, you can just read the caption at the top of IMDb.
All right. Jean Grey begins to develop incredible powers that corrupt and turn her into a Dark Phoenix. Now the X-Men will have to decide if the life of a team member is worth more than all of humanity. Yeah, basically, there's this instance that happens, and she acquires all of this power that she really can't control, and that causes the X-Men to kind of split into fractions and go against her and for her at the same time, and so they kind of have to battle it out and then figure out what to do from there.
Yeah. So the Dark Phoenix saga has long since been one of the most famous and the most adapted of the X-Men comic books. There's, you know, there's been a version in the 90s animated series. There's now been two movie versions. And people always kind of come back to Dark Phoenix because it's this emotionally resonant story. because you're dealing with the life of one of the main characters and, you know, some people not trusting her and some people wanting to help her. And it's a difficult story to get right because there's so many ins and outs to it, as there is with all X-Men stories. There's just a gazillion team members and they all have their own motivations and their own stakes in the plot. And in this case, what's really different about the setup than they tried the last time with X-Men Last Stand is in X-Men Last Stand, the Phoenix was seen as like a further mutation of Jean Grey's telekinetic powers and psychic powers. Whereas in this one, this kind of goes back to the comic in that it's a intergalactic entity that sort of possesses her.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of amplifies or augments her existing powers. It's still a little truncated because I think it's funny that all these movies and everything, they always skip to the Dark Phoenix stuff because that's where all the drama is. But there's supposed to be like a little period of, I don't know, a month or two where she's the Light Phoenix and everyone's cool with her, where she's just this badass on the team who can do anything. And then,
I wish we had seen that.
Yeah.
At the beginning, at least. I wish we had seen them maybe complete a couple of missions, maybe in a montage where she was doing that, because I didn't understand. When the time came that they had to do the first big mission, and this is where those powers enter her and overtake her,
yeah.
I didn't understand exactly why she was going to be the most essential person on this spaceship to rescue the people that were in danger.
Right.
So,
yeah, because the way that they kind of portray it is there's some NASA equipment or some people who needed to be saved or whatever, and they're doing the kind of team style where everyone's using their powers to rescue these people in a certain way, and for whatever reason they write in a reason why she has to be inside the ship right as the supernova that is the Phoenix overtakes the ship. So, you know, I think basically as a truncated version of all the sci-fi stuff that involves this story, because they don't go into like the Shi'ar race and all of that stuff and the Star Jammers and all this pulpy comic book stuff that from the 1970s, that would just be too difficult to fit into a movie like this and would take way too much explanation. I think as far as the way they handled the origin, I thought it actually kind of worked okay. But I do, yeah, I think there would have been more stakes in the plot for her specifically. And we should say she is played by one of those Game of Thrones gals.
Sophie Turner,
who played her in the last few movies, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So, and she gets a lot more to do here than she's done in the previous films.
She first came into Apocalypse, and that was a pretty small role.
Yeah,
her just kind of introducing her.
Yeah, her and Cyclops.
Mm-hmm.
And they get more central roles in this movie. We also see James McAvoy return as Professor Xavier, who seems to be, like, having more and more friction with different parts of the group because he's putting them in greater danger to kind of prove to society that mutants are actually not a problem. And he's trying to, like, work on a PR level.
Yes.
To sort of turn them into beloved superheroes.
That's a compelling storyline, I think. That's a great idea.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff here. This is written and directed by Simon Kinberg. Simon Kinberg has long been a writer on these series, I think since the beginning. But this is the first time he's ever directed anything, as far as I know. And I think that's where you can tell things aren't working quite as well, is specifically in direction.
We agreed after we saw it that the movie, you're in it the entire time, and it's you're fine sitting there and consuming it the entire time, but there's just maybe an overall a little bit of a disappointment for the last half of it.
So the only thing Simon Kinberg's directed up to this point is one episode of the new Twilight Zone series. So yeah, he's pretty green when it comes to being behind the camera. But There's something about it that feels a little stodgy, a little stagey, in the way that the characters are interacting, the way the actors are blocked, the way the dialogue moves. Everyone is kind of exactly on the pitched at the exact same tone, which is this kind of monotone, very serious whisper talk that everyone is kind of doing throughout the whole movie.
I remember the dialogue not being great.
Yeah, and that's kind of a recurring problem in the series, but here it seems a little more pronounced because the actors aren't... I don't feel like they're... Maybe he's not getting as many takes from them to like, okay, you did it like this, now do a take where you're happier. Now do a take where maybe what Professor X said surprised you instead of made you mad, or whatever. And then once you have more takes, you can cut together scenes that are a little bit more dynamic. Whereas it seemed here, he was giving the exact same direction to every single actor. Which is, this is a very serious event. Everyone is very serious about this right now.
Well, there's a catalyst for anger and seriousness that happens pretty early in the movie, which turns Magneto into someone that she has to fight against. And
yeah.
And I did feel like the setup for all of that happening, for basically the X-Men to decide half of them are against her, half of them are for her, and trying to save her and help her, I felt like that was very calculated and not a natural progression of emotions that people would have. Like, there's some people that want to kill her for what happened in the beginning of the movie, and yeah. I feel like that is not... No, that would not be happening.
You didn't believe it.
I did not believe that Magneto would be trying to kill her.
Based upon what we see.
Right.
Yeah. One of the inciting incidences. One of the things I think is seriously missing from this movie is a compelling villain.
Yeah.
Because what we get instead of a Magneto...
is Jessica Chastain.
Who I think is actually giving an interesting performance in the movie, but we know nothing about her. There's just some mysterious alien whatever.
There's an alien race that wants to come to Earth and kind of repopulate because they've lost most of their people.
Yeah, it feels like a less fun version of the Skrull from Captain Marvel. They kind of come to Earth, they disguise themselves as humans.
Yes.
And they're up to no good. And I explained this to you a little bit in the car, that in the original comic book, Jessica Chastain's character, she's not White Queen, but she's essentially playing White Queen in this movie, who was a member at the time of Sebastian Shaw's the Hellfire Club. They can't do that because they already did them in First Class. And so now they just had to create this new bad guy out of thin air to be able to do the things that the Hellfire Club did in the original story. And so because of that, it feels like they just have no motivation. They're just this weird, dark thing. And they're really not that interesting. And it's a big part of the story is when Jessica Chastain is kind of whispering in Dark Phoenix's ears and getting her to, you know, doubt things or to go even further down this kind of dark path. And without, you know, any kind of, like, proper motivation for that character, it's hard to be super invested in all of the dramatic stakes.
Yep.
Would you agree with that?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, I would say ultimately, and I don't know if we agree on this or not, I don't think... A lot of people are shitting on this movie. I've heard even some people say it's the worst one, which I think is insane. That's
not true at all.
Go back, watch X-Men Wolverine, X-Men Origin Wolverine.
Or Apocalypse.
Or even Apocalypse, yeah. And then go back and watch this one. And you know, you might be mad at it right now because it's the most fresh in your mind. But I don't think this movie is the worst by a mile. It's just not great. I would say it's... pretty much kind of, I'd put it maybe a hair above Apocalypse, actually.
I agree. I think Apocalypse isn't really scary or compelling in the stakes that they build, and I would say this one kind of isn't either, but this one is more grounded in the emotional turmoil of some characters, and that is a hair more interesting than Apocalypse.
Right, because Apocalypse was just a bunch of CGI stuff for 2 hours.
Yeah.
Whereas this movie at least is trying to be character-oriented and is trying to, you know, like, further the relationships that are established.
But there are still plenty of characters in this movie that have two-dimensional, no backstory, nothing. I feel like Magneto has no character in this movie. He's just kind of a robot instructed to do whatever the director says.
He's just kind of here. And they always find a way, and there's a lot of things that the sort of Singer universe established that for some reason they just can't see this world in any other way. They always have to shoehorn Magneto in there.
Yeah.
He shouldn't have been in X-Men Last Stand, and he shouldn't have been in this either.
Yeah.
He's just there for no reason whatsoever. And mm-hmm. Michael Fassbender is a great actor, and I'd like to see him in things, but it's clear that he has nothing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And especially when there's already a deficit of villain, like, why bring in Magneto to...
And then technically that part is resolved pretty quickly, and all we're left with is that the Jessica Chastain character, which is, again, two-dimensional. We really don't know enough about them to be scared of them or care about their cause, which... That we could have. We could have cared more about them having a world to reproduce on. And is there a way we can share that world with them here? No, they didn't go into any of that. They basically just figure out a way. Oh, now we've got to get rid of her.
Yeah, I feel like the movie is very, it's very lean in that every scene that we see is there to further story. There's not a lot of backstory.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of world building. It's very much just kind of, it almost feels like a first draft and this of like a, just a skeleton of what needed to be there.
But there's, it's still a 2 hour movie. So you could say a lot happens, which, yeah, that's pretty true. A lot happens. They go to a lot of different places and, you know, but just take some time to talk more about Professor Xavier's PR spin that he's trying to do, or talk more about the reason why this alien population's here and why we should care about that at all.
Yeah. I will say there was one moment where I gasped in excitement. I had like a fanboy moment out of nowhere and I had no one to celebrate it with.
Oh, right.
I looked at you and I'm like, oh yeah, you're not an X-Men comic book reader. But there's a moment where we see Dazzler.
Oh, that's right. That was so bizarre. As someone that doesn't read the comic books, to see that character was... I just was so confused.
Well, I mean, it's like, it's a blink and you miss it kind of scene.
Sure.
But
it still felt really out of place for me. So it was definitely fan service.
I was all in it. I was so excited. I was a little upset that she didn't come back at any point and do anything. Now, Dazzler has, like, garbage powers. All she can do is make light shows,
mm-hmm.
which is... And she's, like, a pop star who becomes a mutant or finds out she's a mutant and joins the X-Men, but...
Feels like Professor Xavier let her into the school out of pity. It's like, aww. You can only do light shows.
Yeah. Not everyone has a cool mutation. I mean, there's a guy named Beak who's just, like, half bird, and he carries a bat.
Oh, sad.
All right, so X-Men Dark Phoenix, I give it like a C+. It's fine.
Yeah, yeah, same.
It's not great. Let's go ahead and move on now to Rocket Man. I was kind of excited to see this movie.
Oh, I was super excited.
And I'm not generally into like rock and roll biopics. Like, I didn't even see the Queen one.
Which was wrong of you.
I know. And it was a Best Picture nominee and everything, but... Speaking of Bryan Singer, but you did see
Bohemian Rhapsody,
and you saw Rocket Man with me, so you might have a different perspective on a lot of this. It's directed by Dexter Fletcher, who also did a little indie that me and Keith reviewed a long time ago called Eddie the Eagle, just a English movie with...
Is that the one with Hugh Jackman skiing?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Did you see that?
No, I didn't.
Oh, it's so good.
I would, yeah.
It's... A fun little sports movie, and Taron Egerton, who before that we'd really only seen in the Kingsman movies, mm-hmm. Which was a very different kind of role because he's this like Absolutely. Overconfident kind of like punk kid
mm-hmm.
Who becomes a spy. And Eddie the Eagle, he plays this kind of nerdy outcasted guy who's just really earnestly wants to be the best that he can be at something. And I kind of fell in love with him in that movie and was like, I am looking out for Taron Egerton now. I think he's going to be a thing.
And he's doing a lot at a young age to build up his resume in a lot of different characters, and that's really great.
Yeah, and like unexpected stuff too. Like he didn't like immediately go for the superhero movie or immediately go for, you know, the leading romantic in something or something like that.
The
like,
Kingsman is pretty heterosexual, dominant male
power
action
fantasy.
But
and technically they are based on a comic book, but it's
and so for him to go to Rocketman playing a gay man and having these relationships on screen that are pretty gratuitous.
Yeah, they go for it.
I think that's so great that he's just not afraid to do any of these things.
So in case you didn't know, this is the rock and roll biopic version of the life of Elton John, singer-songwriter Elton John, most, you know, famous from the 70s through now. And it talks mostly about his younger days, his earlier days, where he meets his co-songwriter and lyricist, Bernie Taupin, sort of brotherly relationship that they have, and where you have a situation where Elton John is this shy introvert who sort of finds himself on stage and is able to express himself in all the ways that he doesn't feel comfortable doing otherwise, unless he is on stage, where he's very flamboyant and he wears these outrageous costumes, feathers and sequins and all of the above, exaggerated sunglasses and the rest of it. And then Bernie Taupin, maybe in real life, is the more assertive and the more confident one of the two, but he's behind the stage and sort of behind the songs and largely isn't even recognized for his contribution to this music. That
I had no idea that that they were a team and worked together and and that his lyrics weren't his own. I had no idea. I mean, of course, you could do a quick Google search and find that out, but I just didn't know until I watched the movie.
I had seen the behind the music a long time ago, so I knew a little bit of this stuff, but not quite to the extent that I get from the movie. And we should say Taron Egerton plays Elton John and Jamie Bell plays Bernie Taupin. We also get Bryce Dallas Howard playing Elton John's mom, who I think does a really good London Cockney accent.
Mm-hmm,
I kind of believed it.
Yeah.
And I don't always with American actors doing British accents in British films. And yeah, so it's kind of a rise and fall story. He, you know, rockets to stardom, if you will. And to sort of mask his uncomfortability with himself and his personal social anxieties, he gets further involved in drugs and alcohol and a toxic relationship with his manager, a sort of secretive relationship that he has with his manager who's taking advantage of him.
Which that's really where the stories of Bohemian Rhapsody and Rocketman are exactly the same. They take place in the same time period. Mm-hmm. There's an addiction to drugs and alcohol and sex, and there's an addiction to having your manager be your boyfriend. So it was so weird to just be like, I'm having deja vu from last year seeing Bohemian Rhapsody. But this movie still stands on its own as its own story about a man who had a different career and a different appearance and everything than
different trajectory, too.
Right, than Freddie Mercury. So yeah, it is still different.
Yeah. And one of them, you know, survived
right
the 80s and the other didn't.
Yep.
So that's interesting also. But I think, and I asked you this because I hadn't seen Bohemian Rhapsody when we came out of the theater. This movie is a lot more explicitly a musical.
Oh, yes.
Where the characters, I mean, it's all Elton John music, but they will, you know, break the fourth wall, stare right at the camera and start singing and go into choreographed dancing in the middle of the streets and everything like that.
Which I love.
And it kind of flows in and out of that. And it feels like, to me, like the movie, it does it a lot more in the first third. And then as the movie is like, almost as the movie is kind of gaining more confidence with the character, or as the story becomes a little bit more involved, they start doing that a little bit less or a little bit more strategically.
Yeah, I think you see his childhood and it's difficult. His dad is quite distant emotionally. And I think it makes sense that he's breaking out into song. And one of the first songs that he sings, the first line is, I want to love. but it's impossible. And so I think it makes sense that as a child, he was really yearning for something. And it makes sense to bring that out in the music that he sings in the movie as a kid, and how he grows up singing these different songs to kind of deal with the lack of parenting and the lack of love that he feels. And as he gets older, he's figuring out better ways to cope with it. And, well, you know, there's like the whole, it takes place in a current time period that he's like in rehab, and then the other rest of his life that he's like telling a story through
rehab. That's the framing device.
Right. The framing device
is that he enters rehab in full stage costume, dressed as like this like sequin devil. And then he's slowly taking off pieces of his costume as he's, you know, telling his story. And we go back in the flashback and get the rest of it. Mm-hmm. Which I think actually that all is constructed pretty well. And it works especially for considering that the movie has a sort of magic realist element to it, exactly, where, you know, the characters will start like flying in while they're singing, yeah, and that kind of stuff.
It, you know, in the trailers, it said based on a real fantasy. So yeah, I think that they were trying to set you up to be okay with the fact that this was going to be a thing that people break out into song and dance right in front of you. And it's not going to, it's going to be more fantastical.
Right, yeah. Then maybe even some of the other music biopics we've seen recently. Mm-hmm. I'll say sometimes the breaking the fourth wall stuff, or some of the ways that the music is integrated, sometimes works better than others. There are some places where I felt like, oh, okay, we're doing this now. And then maybe it's just a matter of I kind of got used to the style or something like that, or like, I became more comfortable with it as the movie went.
Well, as he gets older, he is starting to play these songs on stage and singing them on stage, so it feels less weird.
It feels less, yeah, it's more diegetic. It's it's in conjunction with the scene. They're performance moments rather than musical moments.
Right.
And that stuff, I think, for me, generally works better. Yeah, you know, I'm cool with musicals. This one kind of surprised me a little bit in how straightforwardly a musical it was, but I still really like this movie a lot, particularly for the performances. Mm-hmm. I think they're really good all around. I know Taron Egerton does his own singing, and he sounds and looks like a young Elton John. And the way it's directed, and you know, the sequences of performance are really cool. And I think that they get in all of that kind of behind the music stuff in a way that doesn't feel like they're just going through the motions.
Yeah, I think overall, you couldn't ask for a better biopic of your own life, right? So I think Elton John probably had a big hand in telling what he wanted to be prioritized in the movie and how to wrap it up, because there's this big epilogue where they show real-life pictures of Elton and kind of explain where he went from there in his career. So I think that the problem with biopic movies is that they want to have an overarching theme where the character finds themselves and there's like a happy resolution, whereas in real life, that doesn't really, it's not possible for that to happen because your life continues and you go through different phases and you mess up again and you lose yourself again, you find yourself again. So life is much more rocky and random than this nice three-act movie script. And so that's what I felt like in Bohemian Rhapsody, and I felt a little bit in this one, because it wraps up with this pretty little bow at the end where everything really ends in a happy way, which maybe that's really the case, but I think it makes your life seem a little less real and a little less...
There's too much of kind of like a... like a hero's journey that's imposed on reality.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but I mean, what are you going to do if you're going to do a biopic? You're going to want some kind of hopeful message at the end, probably, because it is based on a real life that had...
Yeah, and I think that they do a really good job, unlike some, where they definitely are just trying to, like, you know, let's say, as a point of comparison, the Netflix biopic The Dirt, which I thought really tried to, like, tap into this rise and fall story a little too neatly and patently.
Right.
This one, I think there's already emotional components there because you have him hiding his sexuality, which then leads to him like becoming more self-destructive. Mm-hmm. So it feels a little bit more honest in that sense.
Yeah.
And I think that stuff also works into larger themes.
The fact that the framing device is him in therapy and in rehab, working through these problems from the ground up, I think it does work way better than Bohemian Rhapsody in the way that he does actually have this redemptive arc that really pays off and you can believe. I think, like I said, Bohemian Rhapsody is just like this neat little package of a life that's not real. Mm-hmm. But I do feel like this one is a case where he really got clean and for the rest of his life really worked hard to, raise money for AIDS and, you know, he started a family. So there really is a happy ending to Elton John's, you know, current life.
So yeah. Yeah.
I think that the framing device with rehab was really clever to do that.
Mm-hmm. And I like that because I wondered when they would cut off mm-hmm. the story because obviously Elton John has had a long career, even past the point. Oh, yeah.
They don't even go into Lion King or Broadway musicals that he does.
Right. Or Princess Diana and all that. Because that was kind of a second or third wind of his career was when he dedicated Candle in the Wind mm-hmm. to her.
Right.
But they don't go into any of that. So I like that they actually decided we're going to kind of truncate the story or keep it just in this moment.
Yeah.
And also kind of make it a period piece as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I liked it. What would you give it if you're grading it?
Maybe a B plus or A minus?
Yeah, I'm about there. I think it's a B plus.
Yeah.
So let's go ahead and move on to Men in Black International. This just came out last weekend. And this is directed by F. Gary Gray, who up to this point he had done Straight Outta Compton, Friday, The Negotiator. Previously, I think all the Men in Black movies before this were directed by Barry Sonnenfeld. So we have a little bit of a stylistic departure there. Also, we have a new cast. This kind of is connected to the other Men in Black films very tangentially as far as just the rules and the world building that those movies established. But really, this is kind of a reboot.
It's really clear that this is a new generation of agents doing this alien stuff, but they don't take you into introducing you to the guns and the weaponry and the training that you go to, like they did with Will Smith's character. They just expect you to already know all of that.
Right, right. This is Saved by the Bell, a new class. Chris Hemsworth plays Agent H, and Tessa Thompson, Agent M. Agent M, or Molly, is kind of a special case as far as recruits go for the Men in Black, because she discovered that the Men in Black were a thing as a kid when her parents are visited by the organization after running into an alien. She avoids being neuralized by the little flash tool that they all use. So she spends the rest of her life trying to figure out who these people were, where they come from, what they do. She kind of becomes obsessed with the secret organization as well as alien activity on Earth. And though she's working as a call center agent or something like that in New York, she's also doubling on, you know, another screen on her computer looking up the whereabouts of the Men in Black.
Yeah, rolling the eyes. Much of this character is not believable, and the things that she has access to and the way that she gets from point A to point B is not believable. That's the first problem with this movie.
Fair enough. So then she eventually finds the Men in Black and their whereabouts, and she convinces them to not neuralize her and send her home, but to train her and put her on a mission. At some point, there's like a time jump that I wasn't aware of, but she gets sent to England to work with Chris Hemsworth, who's a star of the MIB, is kind of their James Bond, and gets into all this trouble and is, has all of these alien alliances on Earth. And there's this big ultimate threat of
the Hive.
The Hive and this little MacGuffin puzzle box that she's given from somebody else. And they have to get it to the right sources. There might be a mole in the agency. So Chris Hemsworth and Tessa Thompson are globetrotting.
I feel like you did not explain that well at all.
So what? How would you?
Basically, she gets sent to London and Chris Hemsworth is a troublemaker, and so she is this like rule follower to a T because she's brand new and has just gone through training and knows the rules, period. And so she acquires this weapon that's really destructive, and she's got to figure out who to give it to. And yes, they think there's a mole in the company.
Right.
Company.
And so the Chris Hemsworth, Tessa Thompson, globetrotting, trying to figure out who to give this magic device to or who to keep it away from.
Sure.
So you already have opinions. Go ahead.
You don't have them yet?
I do. I just, they're not very strong opinions, but go for it.
Well, I think that it's a fun movie, but there's just the character of Tessa Thompson is playing. Like I said, there's a period, like you said, there was a time jump that like both of us kind of weren't aware of, but she goes through training for like a month or something like that, but they don't really show that. And so it seems like she's hired and the next day gets sent to London.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden she knows all of this lingo and how to do some of the lab tests to check on things and figure out where these DNA and molecules are, you know, all of this lingo that she uses. And all of a sudden she knows all of this. And so that was really weird and not believable. And you just get thrown out of the story thinking, how does she know all of these things that Chris Hemsworth's character doesn't? But I guess there was a period where they did not do a good job of showing that she did get training. So.
Yeah, or one has to wonder what we might have, how we might have received the character differently if we'd seen her at some point of struggle.
Yes, she really doesn't ever have a moment of questioning her choices of wanting this career or, there's no real character and internal struggle in her or reason that she wants to do this and have this job other than she was really curious about it as a kid.
Right, but that gets resolved by minute, 20 or something. Right. After she finds out they're real, her character has already had her awakening. Like, that's it. That's her arc takes place in the first 20 minutes.
Right.
And then the rest is just plot.
Right.
And that makes it not necessarily the most interesting movie. Chris Hemsworth seems like he's having fun here. They both do, to a certain extent. His character is, I don't know, there's some like mystery elements to the story.
His character is more interesting because you want to learn more about him and his past and why he went from being a good guy to kind of being a bit of a slacker, showing up to work hungover or late and kind of sleeping with aliens, like to be like get some advantageous information, whereas other agents would not be doing that. And so you kind of wonder what happened there. And you do come into contact with, they have to go and meet with his ex-girlfriend. And you also wonder what the story is there. Are they going to get back together? What's still there? And none of that is explored or explained. And that is just a loss to the interestingness of this entire film.
Agreed. And then also Tessa Thompson's character, her big argument for why they should let her into the agency is because she has nobody in her life. Mm-hmm. She has no friends. She has no family. We know she had parents at some point when she was a kid. What happened to them?
They don't talk about that.
Yeah, where'd they go?
Right.
And then, I feel like there's kind of like something there approaching the character that you could have gone into. It's like, well, why is this person so lonely?
Right.
They don't at all. And then there's a lot of like callbacks to the original series and that kind of stuff too. There's also like a little like alien chessboard figure who's voiced by Kumail Nanjiani. He's funny-ish.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like a little of him goes a long way though. And there's a few places where he overstays his welcome.
Okay.
What do you think?
I think he's fine.
In a movie that's ultimately not working anyway.
Yeah, because at least he brings a little bit of humor into kind of boring characters who aren't explaining themselves.
So. Right, yeah. I guess I think about this movie a lot in conjunction with the first Men in Black. It's like, why does this one not work as well as that one did? Or like, what's missing?
There's a certain chemistry. We've kind of talked about there's a different chemistry between Tommy Lee Jones and Will Smith's characters.
Yeah.
And the way that Will Smith is recruited, that's fun and interesting to see.
Mm-hmm. Because largely the first one is kind of a fish out of water story.
Yeah, and that's a fine plot to like build your story around. And this one, it's not that, because she is the most not out of water story ever. She already knows everything.
She's got it all figured out
right
by the beginning of the movie. In fact, the movie goes really far out of its way to explain that she has it all figured
exactly.
out.
Exactly. So. Like, what is the heart behind her? Or what is the reason that she needs to be essential to this mission? There's really no reason why she's the one who can do it more than anyone else can.
Right, other than the fact that she's a character that they've already established. But,
yeah,
you know, flaws actually make characters interesting.
Mm-hmm. I think they forgot that.
Yeah. And I love Tessa Thompson, too. She's, like, one of my favorite, like, new actresses, and I've been really excited about watching her, like, her career grow and grow as she's, you know, kind of come from obscurity in indie film up through now. But this is very by the numbers and kind of going through the motions. And another thing that I think really separates it is sort of the style of the movie. Barry Sonnenfeld, you know, he was a director of photography for a lot of years, who worked with the Coen brothers and who worked with, he'd done the first two Addams Family films. And so there's a lot of like offbeat stuff. And I think he brings an offbeat sort of satirical edge to his interpretation of at least the first Men in Black film. There's kind of a post Tim Burton vibe to that movie.
Yes. It's really pulpy and yeah, and fun.
And it's kind of like poking fun at genre stuff, mm-hmm. and still harkening back to like the 1950s Green Men from Outer Space movies, right. And that kind of stuff, and playing into the larger sort of culture of sci-fi. Whereas this movie's not really having a conversation with genre in the same mm-hmm. way. It's just a kind of boring
action
guns, movie
and here
that happens to have
them.
Aliens.
Right.
Yeah. So it's just ultimately not that interesting of a movie. I would say this is the type of movie, though, where if you happen to catch it on an airplane,
yeah,
you'd sure. probably be okay with it. Or if you watch it on, like, USA later while you're, like, cooking macaroni and cheese or something. I don't know. Do people still watch cable?
No.
If you happen to catch it on Hulu later,
mm-hmm.
Or if you walk into the room while someone else is watching it and you catch it from the middle on, mm-hmm. you'll be like, oh, yeah, it's a movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty disappointing. It's like a C-minus for me.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. And lastly, we will discuss Jim Jarmusch's new film, The Dead Don't Die. This is a zombie comedy, a sort of zombie parody, written and directed by New York indie God tier, Jim Jarmusch, who's been making movies since, you know, he was like, him and Spike Lee essentially invented independent film as we know it today, back in like 1981 when they released their, or the early 80s when they released their first works. But this one stars pretty much everyone you've ever known, including Bill Murray, Adam Driver, Tom Waits, Chloe Sevigny, Steve Buscemi, Danny Glover, and so on and so forth. Oh, Selena Gomez makes an appearance in this yeah. movie as well.
There's a ton of people in it.
Yeah. Pretty much kind of a familiar take on the zombie genre. So we have the small town where it's a small town where everyone knows everyone. And everyone's in each other's business. And there's a lot of kind of like small town politics between like, you know, the farmer and the guy who's like sleeping in the woods and the police. The police played by Adam Driver and Bill Murray, kind of essentially the main characters mm-hmm. of the story. And it just so happens that on one night of patrol, the Earth has changed polarities because of fracking.
Polar fracking.
The Earth changes polarities and creates a zombie apocalypse, at least in this town. Well, no, it is global, isn't it?
Well, it's not global, but they're watching the news. Selena Gomez is watching the news from her motel room, and she sees that there's several towns right next to where they are that have all been hit with this zombie apocalypse. And
right.
So I don't know if it's just spreading from there or if it is global and they just didn't report that.
So the dead start to rise out of their graves and attack people. And it's up to these kind of, you know, small town hillbillies to take care of it themselves. which doesn't sound like, in and of itself, that description doesn't sound like anything you've never seen before. It sounds incredibly familiar. So I guess what really distinguishes this from other films like it is specifically the style.
That it's a comedy parody, kind of.
Yeah, I mean, there's even been a long history of zombie comedies, though.
Sure, but this one, I think you can tell from the trailer that it's going to be a little off the wall and not quite as sensical as right. some other comedies.
Yeah, it's a little bit more offbeat.
Yeah.
As you would expect from a Jim Jarmusch film. So there's a lot of scenes of, like, conversation set pieces. Mm-hmm. And characters not saying anything at all.
Just hanging out.
just hanging out and kind of soaking it in. And sort of, whereas the zombie aspect of it, for a large part of the film, is more ancillary to getting to know these people and seeing mm-hmm. what they're up to, and
right.
and a lot of the film, especially the first half of the film, I think it sort of spends a long time establishing all of these characters in the small town and how they know each other and what their relationships are, and laying all that groundwork before people start getting eaten.
Mm-hmm.
We went and saw this together, and I was surprised that you were at all interested, because you're not even necessarily, like, a big horror person. In fact, I was, like, amused by how terrified you were of some moments.
Well, they would be over in, like, 5 seconds, because then all of a sudden it would be funny that someone was getting eaten, but at the first moment it was, like, scary to me. So, yeah. The reason why I wanted to see it is because I like Adam Driver and Bill Murray, and I feel like the duo of them taking on a zombie movie, that sounds funny and that sounds interesting.
Yeah.
So that's the only thing that's good about it. No, I'm joking. I'm joking. I think there's... he's obviously trying to input this message and his own agenda, the director, as he's making this and making allusions to the metaphors in the movie. But
right.
And that's okay. I don't need all of that parenting and lecture during this movie.
Yeah. Well, especially because, so, you know, he makes allusions to, like, a climate crisis. He makes allusions to fracking. He makes allusions to, you know, we see the Steve Buscemi character wearing what is kind of basically a Make America Great Again hat. And then, like, his relationship with another black character. And so there's, like, a kind of a post-Trumpian thing going on there. And then later, when we get into the zombie stuff, he very explicitly in monologue mm-hmm. describes, you know, this as a metaphor for, you know, people sort of being zombified by
their
materialism and commerciality and mm-hmm. that kind of stuff as well, which seemed like by that point in the movie, especially after he'd already kind of touched on these other subjects, the least interesting way to go.
Absolutely. Yes. And so in the car, we were talking about that this movie really came about 10 years too late. The hype of the zombie movies was around the late 2000s, yeah. 2008, 2009, 2010.
Yeah.
And so for this movie to come out and for it to be about zombies and people getting eaten, it just seems not quite fashionable right now. And
So
we both agreed we don't think that a lot of people are going to even see this movie. But the fact that it also just pushes all of that symbolism and those messages down your throat makes it even less of a fun movie, because if it had just all ended in destruction, like, that would have been fun. But the fact yeah. that he's talking about, like, everyone's on their cell phone and that makes you terrible, it's like, fuck off. Like, I don't mind I thought that the reason why people are turning into zombies because of the polar fracking, I thought yeah. that was a great, smart idea, that it would throw off the world so much that that could happen. Okay, fine. But the rest of it is just disappointing that they... I mean, there's characters who are driving smart cars and Priuses, and you're like, oh, those are going to be the people who are, like, right, more green-friendly, and those characters are going to survive. No, none of that matters. Like, none of that's a payoff, so what's the point of having that in there?
Right, but it was addressed, like, and it seemed intentional.
It was absolutely intentional.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm kind of with you on the messaging in the movie. I think it's pretty heavy-handed and not necessarily, like, clever.
Yeah.
Certainly not as clever as the movie thinks it is.
And not the greatest message. What were we saying in the car? It could have been the reason why we are materialistic, and the reason why we are on our phones all the time is because that's how we consume media. That's all there is to do nowadays, because we're all so poor because we're not making a living wage because corporations are evil. That's what I wanted to know. That's what I wanted to hear.
And that's not even, like, outside of the realm of something he could or would discuss. So,
He talked about the baseline problem, but we obviously have a bigger problem, which is that America and its culture and the way that billionaires run it, it has allowed it to be this way. Why don't you take on that? That's what I thought it should have been.
All right. Dem socialist Ashley over here with her. No, I agree with you, actually. I think that would have been at least a more modern take. I mean, if you're going to create, you know, some sort of allegory about why we're zombies or why we're transfixed to the thing. Because one of the tropes in the movie is that when the zombies awaken, they go back to immediately to the things that they were obsessed with when they were alive, whether it's, you know, alcohol or coffee or sports or whatever it was. They just start enacting what they did when they were alive, which goes all the way back to Romero's Dawn of the Dead, when everyone returns to the mall because that's what they know. So all of that was already explored.
Mm-hmm.
That commercialism. Yeah, it's been done, and it was done, you know, frankly, more clever in Romero's 70s zombie film. But I don't want to shit on this movie entirely, because I think there is stuff in it that works. It's occasionally funny, and sometimes very funny. I think you have a really talented cast here, and Jim Jarmusch is really good at, like, creating these kind of, you know, wild casts of, you know, musicians and actors and people you wouldn't expect to, like, you turn a corner, oh, there's Iggy Pop, you turn a corner, oh, or whoever might end up in one of these movies. And so you have this, like, you know, kind of vibrant potpourri of characters.
And he does a good job of setting up the tone and the atmosphere. Like we said, there's a lot of time where the characters are just driving around in a police car doing their patrol. And there is a certain charm to the world building that he does in the first half.
Yes. Yeah. And I think we do get to know these characters well. So when the shit hits the fan, we do care about their well-being in the movie. And there's some really wild stuff in this movie. Like, it goes cuckoo bananas at a point.
I love that phrase.
But yeah, so it's a little disappointing. It's kind of too little too late as far as this genre goes. And, you know, I mentioned to you, one of the last films that Jim Jarmusch did was another sort of take on a horror trope, which was Only Lovers Left Alive, starring Tilda Swinton and Tom Hiddleston. And I thought that his interpretation or modern interpretation of the vampire thing was a lot more clever and off the beaten path and a more incisive take than what he does here with the zombie genre. So I would say if you're interested in Jim Jarmusch or you like kind of quirky horror comedies, there's enough here to enjoy, because about every five scenes there's a good chuckle to be had. But overall, if you're looking at, like, if you're grading it on the curve of, like, horror comedy, it's kind of lacking.
Yeah,
for me it's like I don't know, because we've graded a lot of things on, like, C's and stuff.
It's
a little more unique of a movie going experience in those movies.
There's a lot to laugh at, but I really, you're not doing a good job of being a director and writing a story if you have to write a monologue near the end that's comparing your cell phone to being a zombie. You can show that through action, and you can show that through your storytelling and the visual. You should not have to say outright.
I felt like that was already explored.
And so for that reason, I really feel like it's graded lower.
There's also a moment in the movie, and I don't know why it was there, like, story-wise, it does nothing really, where
Tilda Swinton's character.
No, I love her. Everything, I'm all for it. Everything she does in the movie, I'm definitely 100%.
Like, well, it's so fun.
When she's driving down the streets in a smart car and has a samurai sword.
So fun to watch her entire performance, but it is so weird what ends up happening to her.
Yeah, no, I'm all about that. And it might be a reference to Repo Man. I'm not sure because there's moments like that in that movie as well. For whatever reason, Adam Driver's character is like cognizant of the fact that they're in a movie.
Yeah.
And he keeps bringing attention to like the script and that kind of stuff. And they have
the theme
like,
song.
Yeah. And it's funny-ish, but it's never like addressed in any kind of overarching way. It's just like these tossed off lines of dialogue.
Yeah.
So I just don't understand what that was doing.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
It felt a little half-baked, like a lot of the movies. So, yeah, I guess I'm going to give it, like, a C+.
What? Oh, yeah. I think because of the amount of laughter, I would say maybe C-, but there's a lot of stuff that, like, its heavy-handedness that I really didn't like, and I would give that portion of it, like, a D-.
The zombie gore works. Mm-hmm. Like, the zombie stuff that's in the movie is, you know, when they do it well.
There's good effects. And
yeah. So, yeah.
It's fun to be nihilistic and just, like, see all of these people get eaten.
That's true. All right. So, where are we now? Do we want to talk about the Jonas Brothers movie?
Yes.
All right. I'll let you describe it then. What is this called, even?
It's called Chasing Happiness. We happened to watch this last night. We started it a couple weeks ago or something and finally finished it last night. But it's we both know nothing about the Jonas Brothers, and we don't know their music or anything about them.
Yeah, before the movie, I could not tell you a single song they sung.
Mm-hmm. And I even kind of knew more about Nick Jonas's and Joe Jonas's solo adventures, like DNCE and like Eat Cake by the Ocean, and then Nick Jonas's song Jealous. Mm-hmm. So I knew those songs, but that is it. That's my knowledge of the Jonas Brothers. So we both watched this going into it kind of curious, and we find out that their dad is a pastor at this church, and they kind of grow up in this small town and then explode. And so you see the arc of their career and how they have come to be at the place they're in currently, which is that they've just had a comeback and they've just put out an album after having not done one together in like 7 or 9 years or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's interesting. And they really talk about the issues and the bitterness and problems that they had in their relationships, which caused the rift and the ultimate separation of them for many years. So I thought that was great.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
You know, I kind of watched it ironically. Or with you when you decided to start it, but I actually did become invested in the story, and I mean, I know nothing about the Jonas Brothers. I was well beyond too old for them. Mm-hmm. When they were a thing, so I was already out of high school.
Yeah,
when they were, you know, had their first couple hits on the I guess the radio or Disney.
Yeah, they talk about getting signed by a Disney label, which was what really threw them into stardom, and then doing a show on the Disney Channel, which I had no idea that happened.
Yeah.
I was just about just a few years older than having been interested in that. So I was just a little too old for the Jonas Brothers. So, right.
But I remember them being like huge.
Two 13-year-olds, which did not appeal to either of us.
No, but I, you know, like shortly thereafter, Justin Bieber blew up, and mm-hmm. then shortly thereafter, One sure. Direction blew right. up, and I have no interest in any of that either. But mm-hmm. I couldn't avoid their stardom because they were just so everywhere, so ubiquitous. And it was kind of the same way with the Jonas Brothers. And I mentioned to you before we started watching the documentary, the only thing I knew about them was the purity ring thing.
Oh, right.
Because
they definitely talk about that.
Yeah, because it was like a marketing thing or something from Disney.
Well, at first, they said it really started from their community, which they lived in a small town. Their dad was a pastor. So everyone in their community, everyone that they knew was part of this church. And so that was the thing that you do. That's part of fitting into your culture, is taking a vow of chastity until you're married and wearing that purity ring, which when Disney found out about that, they said, oh, that's great. Like, let's play that up. So
right.
they did talk about getting annoyed with that at a certain point and wanting to really abandon that because of their working relationship with Disney, they talk about how they were quite stifled in their own development as humans and not being able to really explore what it means to fall in love with a girl or be with anyone. And so I really feel for them. And it's just one of the many reasons why being a child star is so difficult and it can really fuck you up.
Right.
They're very lucky that they're on the other side of that and they are still successful and that they're all happily married now.
And relatively normal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're looking at, like, you know, the long line of people who came from child star and end up with these really difficult lives where they have to, like, quit talking to their parents or emancipate themselves or, you know, get involved in drugs
heavy. Yeah, addicted to drugs. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Like, that didn't happen to any of them. For the most part, they kept it together pretty well.
Right.
Now, they might have had some strain in their relationships because the way the fame was sort of tearing them apart or, like, you know, singling out one brother against the other or whatever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they talked about how they started out with nothing, got dropped from a couple labels, moved to the Disney label, then blew up, and then, you know, it seemed like they released a third album or something, just all their fan base sort of evaporated.
Yeah, I was reading more about this last night, just out of curiosity. So it came that they had put out a fourth album, which hadn't really done as well, and then they were going to do a fifth one. They announced the title, and they released a few songs from it, and they started performing some of the songs from that new album that was going to come out, and then all of a sudden, they just broke apart, and they canceled the album, they canceled the entire world tour that they were about to do. Because there was just too much emotional turmoil between these brothers, which I think had it not been brothers, maybe they would have, you know, they would have had signed a contract and probably would have had to have followed through with all of that. And and so the fact that they're a family, they were kind of able to agree all together. Yeah, none of us are going to do this and we're going to have to forego that income and everything that comes along with it. Because we just can't be together. So I think that's an interesting dilemma, whereas something like NSYNC, that probably wouldn't have happened.
No, probably not.
So,
yeah.
But it is incredible that they went and saw, like, a family counselor and did therapy so that they could come back together. And they actually said that before they made this album that just came out on June 7th, that they had spent the previous year in counseling and traveling the world together to just kind of, like, build up their bond again, because they hadn't hung out in a few years. And one of them was this dad to two daughters, and he was just, like, living in Jersey with his wife and not doing anything, and the other two were in bands and performing.
Yeah, and Nick had Jonas hits on the radio.
Nick Jonas was in movies, and so one of them was completely, like, off the grid, basically. So the fact that they were able to come back together and bond and heal that relationship, that's really great. I think that's wonderful to watch and see.
I mean, that's what the movie wants us to believe. Sure. Do you 100% believe it?
Oh, yeah.
You think they're good now?
Yeah, because just being a bond of being brothers, that's stronger than...
You don't think they're just cashing in?
No, I don't think so, because they said the reason we have enough money to live on, we've got our own other side projects where two of them were solo and they were totally fine making that music and having fun with it. So they said really the only reason why we came together is because we did miss being together and playing together. And they said the only reason why they did this album was because it's called Happiness Begins, is because they want to have fun.
All right. What did you think of the little... I thought it was a writing device. I didn't necessarily think that we were capturing a true moment when they're playing the card game and drinking and, like, having these State of the Union-like conversations about exactly how they feel about certain events in their life. And then they would cut to that into flashback or...
Sure. I think they decided to do this little drinking game to create some footage for this documentary.
Right. I thought it was a clever way for the documentarian to kind of create a spine to the story.
Mm-hmm. But it's also a clever way to let fans into what were the problems, what did tear them apart, because for so many years, no one knew. They just figured, oh, they're not getting along. And so this was really like, where did we go wrong? What did we regret in our careers? And so they came up with these answers. And that really is like an answer to here's why we're making this documentary. Here's why we left you guys. Here's why you don't know what happened is because we were ashamed of these things.
Right.
I thought that was a different and interesting way to get that conversation going so we could have some answers.
Yeah, I agree. I thought it worked. I thought one of the most interesting things about the story that's not necessarily what the documentary is about, but it's just how ephemeral fame is.
Yeah.
And how tricky it is and how it can go just as fast as it came.
Yeah.
And when you're the flavor of the month, it can feel like you have, you know, hordes of people who are obsessed with you. And then you can go for the summer and come back and nobody cares because they're on to the next thing.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of people who just get, like, you know, totally devastated in those cycles because they're not really emotionally prepared for fame or the loss thereof.
Right.
More so than this, like, little reunion album or anything, then we'll see how long this reunion lasts. But I think it was encouraging to see them all, like, deal with that in a professional, successful way.
Right.
Like, even the guy who just stays home and takes care of his daughter and is always being mistaken for one of the other brothers
Right. When
he's in public.
Right.
And he seemed kind of bummed out about it and felt a little jealous that they had their own thing going on. He didn't. But I think even he, like, all of them dealt with the crush of fame and being pushed out of the spotlight in pretty adult, healthy ways.
Mm-hmm.
Even if they weren't talking to each other
Right. For
a couple years.
Right.
As a curious little music doc of even, you know, something I'm not necessarily interested in at all, I was pretty entertained by this documentary and found it mostly interesting. We should say this is, even though this is where we would normally have our Netflix homework, this is an Amazon original.
Yeah.
I thought it was Netflix when we were watching it, but it's not.
It's on Prime Video.
Yeah, so if you watch it on there, you should be able to find it. And it's mildly interesting, especially if you want some, like, mid-2000s nostalgia.
Yeah.
Some of those old music videos.
Right, that was funny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, my pleasure.
And if anybody has anything to say about anything we've talked about here, you can contact us at our email at MacGuffinPod@gmail.com. You can also find us on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Player.fm, Pocket Cast, and not the Windows Podcast Network, because I don't think that exists anymore. You can also read the writing that I've done for the Idaho State Journal at idahostatejournal.com. The arts and entertainment section and the movie section, you'll see the stuff that I've written there. You can also find the RSS to the podcast and all of the articles that I've written for the MacGuffin's website at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. Follow us over on Twitter and Instagram at MacGuffinPod. Keith has stuff. You can find it on keithfosterkid.com. That's where he has where he posts all of his shows and all of his comedy stuff that he does in San Diego. Is there anything you want to promote?
I just opened an Etsy shop, so if you want to check that out, it's Ever Fun Co., all one word. So check that out. Check out the Instagram of the same name, and you can check me out on Instagram at Ashley Hitchcock, spelled exactly like Alfred Hitchcock. Oh, and Ashley Hitchcock is spelled with two E's, A-S-H-L-E-E.
Yes, and you've been going to town on that Etsy.
Yeah.
Like, I've been up here watching you.
He said I'm a one-man sweatshop, so I've got lots of stuff in the shop. Check it out.
Yeah, and I think we'll leave it there, actually. So with that, we'll just say bye-bye.
Adieu.